This is CBS News on the Hour, sponsored by O'Reilly Auto Parts.
I'm Vicki Barker. Former President Donald Trump delivers a campaign speech urging Christians to vote once.
During his speech, Trump encouraged Christians to come out and vote. He said that he wants to win in a landslide so big that it's too big to rig, and that if he is brought into power, they won't have to vote again in 4 years because he'll have fixed the country.
CBS's Natalie Brand reporting. In Northern California, fleeing the Park Fire.
I got all my important papers, all my pictures off the pictures, all the wall, off the wall, all my bank accounts, my cats, my dogs.
More than 300,000 acres already burned. Evacuations ordered in four counties. Across the border in Canada, a fast-moving wildfire has destroyed parts of the historic mountain town of Jasper in one of Canada's most treasured national parks. The verdict of visitors to last night's rain-soaked, star-studded opening ceremony of the Paris Games.
Truly like a dream come true. Even though it was raining, it was just magical.
It was also just mortifying for the organizers when they realized they'd gotten one country's name badly wrong.
At the opening ceremony, South Korea was introduced as the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, but that's North Korea's name. South Korea's is the Republic of Korea. The embarrassing mistake led the IOC to apologize on social media. Its president will also meet with the leader of South Korea. Wendy Gillette, CBS News, Paris.
On the first full day of competition, Team USA has a silver in the 3-meter synchronized springboard competition, and the men's gymnastics team is through today's qualifying round. To the Middle East now, and Palestinians sheltering in a safe haven in Gaza are being told to get out. The BBC's Mark Lowen has that.
The Israeli Defense Forces have dropped flyers, and they have sent SMS messages and voice notes and made media appearances urging people to leave a part of Al-Mawasi. Now, that is a 16-square-kilometer strip of land on the coast in southern Gaza, which had been designated a humanitarian zone. Now, a part of that zone, a southern chunk of it, has now, the Israeli military say, being used to for rocket attacks against the Israeli army and for, as they call it, terrorist infrastructure. So basically what they have done is that they have redesignated or adjusted the boundaries of the humanitarian zone by saying that that southern little bit of Al-Mawasi is no longer a safe humanitarian zone.
Gaza's latest death toll, more than 39,000. This is CBS News.
Think O'Reilly Auto Parts for all your car care needs. Get the parts and service you need fast from the professional parts people at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Your news, conversations, and a whole lot of fun. It's all on your local Civic Media radio station or the Civic Media app.
For Civic Media News, I'm Terry Bell. Vice President Kamala Harris put the spotlight on student loan forgiveness at the recent American Federation of Teachers conference. Here's Danielle Smith.
The Biden administration has canceled over $62 billion in federal student debt for more than 871,000 public service workers nationwide, including teachers. Presidential candidate Kamala Harris spoke at the conference. She told them the administration sees a future with affordable health care, affordable child care, and paid leave for all.
We see a future where every student has the support and the resources they need to thrive, and a future where no teacher has to struggle with the burden of student loan debt. So as an example, our administration has forgiven student loan debt for nearly 5 million Americans.
She pointed out that the federal student debt relief plans, including the Public Service Loan Forgiveness Program, face potential threats due to legal challenges and some resistance from Republicans in Congress. A Pennsylvania recipient of student loan forgiveness introduced Vice President Harris. Brittany Schaub is a special education teacher in the Pittsburgh Public Schools. Schaub said she heard about the Public Service Loan Forgiveness Program, or PSLF, but most people who applied for it didn't receive it during the last administration.
The Biden-Harris administration fixed PSLF and made the process easy, so I applied. and later had my student loans forgiven. And now I help my fellow teachers get the debt forgiveness they deserve.
The AFT conference wrapped up Thursday in Houston. I'm Danielle Smith. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to Civic Media News. I'm Terry Bell.
This is your hometown radio, refreshed, keeping you informed, entertained, and connected locally across the Civic Media Network.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. For today, sunshine, highs in the upper 70s. Partly cloudy, 68 tonight. Slight chance of a thunderstorm for your Sunday with a high around 82. Scattered storms Sunday night, a low around 70, and a couple of thunderstorms possible on Monday. Otherwise, partly sunny with highs in the mid-80s.
It's 67 right now.
Maggie Dawn.
Next, have you heard of the recombobulation area? Well, Dan Schaefer's sitting in the host chair, folks. Don't miss it.
The Maggie Dawn Show, weekday afternoons from 2 till 4. You're listening to The Shaw, WAUK. Welcome to Amicus, a law review with Jim Santel. Civic Media's weekly review and discussion of some of the most significant news stories in the areas of law, government, courts, and the aspiration for justice. And now, here's your host, Jim Santel.
This is Amicus, a law review. My name is Jim Santel, your host for this, our second hour on our weekend weekly roundup, a review of all things related to justice and law and government in America. Spending most of our first hour talking about the absence of any basis upon which these forthcoming and present lawsuits challenging the Democratic nominee for the presidency, the insufficiency, the inadequacy, the lack of any substance to these various lawsuits being brought to challenge what's going on inside the Democratic Party, and also then talking now about the United States Supreme Court and some very interesting comments made by one of the justices, Elena Kagan, when she is at the Ninth Circuit Conference just this past week, talking about the need for an enforcement mechanism for a true and credible ethics code, commenting that while she regards the Chief Justice with great regard and regards him as someone she respects and admires, that he should put together some sort of a panel, some sort of a committee, presumably of lower court judges, to make these determinations about an enforceable code of ethics. And significant not only because of the identification for the first time by her or other justices about this enforcement issue, which is significant, the mechanism for actually imposing upon the justices, they follow some rules and regulations when it comes to their conduct, their recusals, their behavior, but also a way of ensuring that they themselves are not policing themselves, as she said, and looking presumably to some other set of judges, some other committee, as she proposed, of federal judges who would impose their perspectives on those of the associate justices and the chief justice. Fascinating to think about that. And again, significant because of the articulation by this associate justice of this view. She'd commented a couple of other things that are also relevant to what we see a lot. We saw a lot of this in this past term. She also criticized the number of concurrences being written by justices in connection with majority and even other opinions that are attached, even dissent. She said that the code of conduct, as important as it is also accompanied by some frustration that she has with a large number of these concurrences of her colleagues issuing in cases. And she says it's not a good thing for the court. Those are her words. And what are concurrences? Concurrences are these additional writings that the justices will attach to majority opinions, saying, I agree with what the majority is doing. I agree with the overall result of the court. But I want to write something specially to explain why it is that I come to that same result, why I think I should be heard on this. And she goes on to say this. She says, I think all these concurrences prevent us from giving the kind of guidance that lower courts have a right to expect, the public has a right to expect. It muddies the waters of our decisions, she says. She specifically pointed the court's decision, which we've talked a lot about here on this broadcast, this case of Rahimi, this major Second Amendment case the court decided not too long ago, majority by an 8-1 ruling, upholds this federal ban on a domestic abuser's right to have guns. You cannot possess, cannot use weapons in this country if there is a pending domestic violence restraining order against you. Supreme Court affirmed that federal law, that federal prohibition in this case called Rahimi, 8-1 ruling. And Justice Roberts, Chief Justice Roberts, wrote that decision for the majority. But a flurry of separate writings followed that, and we talked about some of those by many members of the court. And that prompted Elena Kagan just this past week to comment about that. She says everybody sort of tries to spin it one way or another. Often people use separate opinions to pre-decide issues that aren't properly before the court and that may come before the court in a year or two. And they try then to sort out or give some signals to how lower courts should decide that. She says, which I don't think it's right. There are definitely times, she says, when separate opinions make sense. And she notes that she wrote one of those this session. But she says, I think all the time that we're in a position where we look at the majority opinion and we say, not the way we would have written it, but I think we should have a higher threshold for saying, but it will do. It's okay. It's enough. I agree with it enough. And the world doesn't need to hear my separate thoughts on a better opinion that could have been written. Again, advocating for fewer concurrences so that the waters are not muddied for all of us, including the lower courts. Fascinating to hear her talk about that frustration that she has on the Supreme Court. And then she also joins with all of this a concern about the so-called emergency document. She says she's growing impatient with the increased use of the court's emergency docket, in which the court can issue unsigned and unexplained orders that allow the justices to act on a certain case, while also pretty much shielding the legal analysis behind the decision and the exact vote count by the justices themselves. The use of the emergency, sometimes called the shadow docket, increased dramatically during the Trump administration, as we have talked about previously. The Justice Department seeking to use that docket and seeking relief in various cases that affect very significant issues. Under the Biden administration, GOP states and other private litigants have also used the docket in challenging various federal actions, often forcing the court to hear the merits of those disputes in this sort of emergency setting. The Biden administration has also used it from time to time. Everybody, according to Elena Kagan, using it much too much. She says, because we have granted a number of them in the early years of the Trump administration, I think it encouraged people to keep bringing these kinds of petitions for emergency relief from various lower court orders. And significantly, there are several matters that are pending on the Supreme Court's docket right now on this emergency docket. We're going to talk about one of them soon in this hour, having to do with the Department of Education's rules under Title IX, and that also affect transgender issues in America. Those cases immediately coming up to the court and also a part of the emergency docket, also a part of what Elena Kagan is criticizing, overusing the emergency docket, the so-called shadow docket, a part of her criticism of the court in the Ninth Circuit Conference just this past week. Interesting to hear from her about all of these things, especially this focus that plainly she has still on the need for an enforceable ethics code, proposing that it be administered by a group of non-Supreme Court justices somewhere in the federal judiciary to review what the Supreme Court justices are doing in terms of ethics, in terms of recusal, in terms of their behavior, and making that the enforcement mechanism for whatever the code may be. Fascinating to hear from Elena Kagan just this past week. Also good to hear from callers here on Amicus Law Review. Appreciate always your questions, your inquiries at 844-967-2789, or also drop us a question in the Civic Media feed, the online app. Mark from Prairie du Sac, Mark calling in this weekend. Appreciate, as always, Mark, your question or your inquiry.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. Yeah, it seems to me that the Constitution itself calls out for a code of ethics or implies a code of ethics based on how Article 2 ends in the Constitution with what civic officers can be removed for. I believe it's treason, bribery, high crimes, and other misdemeanors. And then Article 3, it starts out with it, judges serve during times of good behavior. So if you link those two together, good behavior should include not accepting any kind of bribes or gratuities, which is a ridiculous thing. Well, if you take it after the fact, it's not a bribe anymore. It's just a gratuity. The Supreme Court just came up with it. It's just ridiculous to me because even in antiquity, it was not accepted that judges should be taking bribes. It was something that was deeply concerning to the rulers at the time. You know, the people actually had to trust the law, even though the law at the time was probably a sorry sop to the common individual out there. They figured the law had to be a sacrosanct and be above taking, the judges actually taking bribes. I mean, that it is disturbing to me also that we have members of the Supreme Court that apparently have voiced opinions that the 13th, 14th, and 15th, and probably the 16th Amendment aren't valid amendments to the Constitution because they're actually forced upon the recalcitrant states being brought back into the Union, the Confederacy. And they were forced to sign off on those amendments because to actually rejoin the Union. So they have made arguments that those amendments are not valid.
Right. And lots of things to unpack there, Mark, including your very good thoughts about this ethics notion that it does, in fact, derive from what is Article 3 of our Constitution, which is the article that establishes our federal judiciary. It's implicit in all of that language there. And beyond that, the people of America anticipate that when they get decisions from our Supreme Court and our lower courts as well, that all of those decisions are a product of independent, unbiased, unprejudiced views about what the law and the facts command and require, and are not the product of some internal bias or prejudice that they may have, or some connection to the parties who are appearing right in front of them, things that they've gotten, also just generally to know about the sources of income for our justices, for our judges. That's also good to know, simply to affirm that we know what the representatives, whether it's in Congress, whether President of the United States of America, where they're getting their monies. That is a significant thing for an open and complete democracy to understand about its leadership. And always, always, Mark, appreciate your good insights and questions. We appreciate also, again, the notion that our Congress, which I just mentioned, is also dealing with what the Supreme Court has done just this past term. We have talked a lot about this major decision issued on June 28th in this case called Loper Bright Enterprises, basically changing the way that government works and finding that the deference long established for 40 years under this principle called Chevron is no longer the rule of law in America. Giving great power to federal judges, it really is identified in many ways as a significant, dramatic, one of the most significant changes in the way that government works. Well, it turns out that Congress has noted that and has already beginning to introduce legislation that is going to overturn that decision in Loper Bright Enterprises. Among others in the United States Senate is Senator Elizabeth Warren, introducing bills that would restore that previous standard under which federal agencies did, in fact, have discretion to interpret the law when they issued regulations under statutes issued by the Congress, also appropriately giving those agencies the authority to act. Has the backing already inside the Senate of 9 other Democrats, others, it's picking up steam there. Beyond that, Elizabeth Warren talking about the reasons for this, including transparency and efficiency to federal rulemaking, making certain corporate interest groups can't substitute their preferences for the judgment of Congress and the expert agencies. As we continue here on Amicus Law Review, we're going to talk more about what's going on in Congress in response to those recent decisions of the United States Supreme Court.
The Shaw, WAUK.
Hey there, it's Carrie Joy with your Work Money Minute and a couple thoughts about cryptocurrency. Now I'm going to say right up front that I am married to a man who has a little bit of cryptocurrency, so I know there are some smart and very handsome folks in that space and that money can be made in it. Now with that out of the way, I'm going to quote Michelle Singletary, who's the Washington Post money columnist, and she recently said, "Investing in crypto is highly speculative and inappropriate for most everyday investors." I think she nailed it for those of us who don't work in the money trading business. People who got in early, at least some of them, have done okay. And even when you hear about record highs for Bitcoin or Ether, just know that there are plenty more epic plummets that might not be making your feed. Okay, folks, that was your Work Money Minute. For more money tips, check out workmoney.org. Till next time, I'm Carrie Joy saying take good care.
You're listening to The Shaw, WAUK, Waukesha's home for Matinee on Air.
This is Jim Santel, and yes, this is Amicus Law Review. We are doing all things law, government, and administration of justice in our nation, including the attention provided by the United States Congress, United States Senate, the House of Representatives in recent days to these recent decisions of the United States Supreme Court. One of them involving Loper Bright Enterprises is the name of the case. That case involving this notion that the agencies of our federal government are no longer given the deference due to them based upon their expertise, the insight that they have in doing their jobs. The Chevron doctrine rescinded, revoked, dismissed, and kicked to the curbside by the United States Supreme Court in this Loper Bright Enterprises case. Legislation introduced in the United States Senate by Elizabeth Warren, joined in by others, restore that standard, that Chevron standard, in the legislative mechanism through that process. The law, the proposed legislation, is called the Stop Corporate Capture Act, interesting name for it, and would write Chevron deference back into the law, restore what the Supreme Court took away, and would basically undercut what the Supreme Court recently did, giving agencies more discretion that was taken away from them by the Supreme Court in that recent decision. Interestingly, while the senators are there, they're also focusing on some other things related to agencies. The legislation advanced by Senator Warren and others would also bolster agency rulemaking in some other significant ways. Provisions aimed at streamlining an often very lengthy process. We know that as a part of the rulemaking mechanism. And also to defend the independent scientific expertise, the people who know what they're talking about inside these agencies by doing a number of things and quite requiring, for example, anyone submitting public comments to disclose their industry-funded research or any other potential conflicts of interest. In other words, when you submit comments to suggest that the agency, the expertise inside the agency should either be supported or not supported. Requirement under the law that you also identify the source of any funding for your research and any potential conflicts of interest in this very issue. Interesting add-ons as the United States Senate and also, I should indicate, the House of Representatives also introducing legislation advanced principally by Representative Pramila Jayapal from Washington. She's done the same thing in the House of Representatives. All of this legislation designed to overturn, to pull back on what the Supreme Court recently did. Of course, a big lift in Congress right now as the majority of the Republicans in the House, majority of the Democrats in the Senate, both razor thin, but nonetheless, introduction of legislation to move in that direction. To the same end, efforts in the United States Congress to overturn the decision in Trump versus United States that establishes shockingly this notion that our executive branch, our presidents have some forms of immunity for crimes committed while they're in the Oval Office. Introduction of constitutional amendments in both houses of Congress to overrule that decision and establish that indeed there is no such thing as presidential immunity. Among others, Representative Joe Morrell, who is a Democrat from New York, introduced a constitutional amendment on Wednesday of this past week seeking to undo that Supreme Court decision that former presidents, current presidents do enjoy some presumption of criminal immunity and even absolute immunity for some things. He said this, early this month, the Supreme Court of the United States undermined not just the foundation of our constitutional government, but the foundation of our democracy. This is Representative Morrell. He said, at its core, our nation relies on the principle that no American stands above another in the eyes of the law. And as a result of that, the representative has introduced this legislation that begins the process for a constitutional amendment requiring, obviously, endorsement by both houses of Congress And after that, endorsements by three quarters of the states. A huge lift, but nonetheless, beginning that process. Morrell said, the American people expect their leaders to be held to the same standards we hold for any member of our community. Presidents are not monarchy, he said. They are not tyrants and should not be immune. Thus, the introduction of this immunity package, this attempt to amend the Constitution to overcome what the Supreme Court has done in this case. Note also that the White House has indicated that sometime in this coming week, early in this coming week, President Joseph Biden is going to be announcing a similar package of proposals, legislative and constitutional amendments that address the same kinds of things. The only thing he is not going to be addressing is a notion of increasing the number of justices, which could also be done legislatively without a constitutional amendment. He is also concerned, again, about ethics. He is concerned about this immunity concept and other matters that presumably will be a part of his proposal to the United States Supreme Court, including a proposal for term limits, an interesting concept given what the Constitution says. All of that coming up, making this a continuing hot issue and meaning that the decisions by the Supreme Court, while they remain good law as of today, certainly are attracting not only the attention of members of our Congress, should be attracting the attention of every single American. They changed the way the government works, and they changed our very Constitution, the checks and balances that are out there. That decision having to do with Trump immunities and the Trump cases, of course, also impact virtually all of the cases pending in the federal and state courts as well. Those criminal cases, the four of them that we've talked about at great length in the past. Let's revisit some of those as well right now. We know that Tanya Chutkan, who is the district court judge who is presiding over the federal election interference case in the District of Columbia, she has now been given these cases back to her, the Trump immunity case, to try to sort out what is and is not official, what is and is not an absolute immunity and a presumptive immunity. Also sorting out what is left of this case after all of the evidentiary and procedural restrictions imposed upon the prosecutor by that Supreme Court case. She has now got back on her docket this case to figure out what comes next. Presumably some hearings with counsel to solicit from them their views upon what should and should not happen here. Major question that she will be asking is what is left after the United States Supreme Court virtually decimates major portions of that criminal indictment against Donald Trump, including establishing complete absolute immunity for anything engagement, any communications that he had with the United States Department of Justice. She will be entertaining that. She has got no small task. She is one of the judges in our land most burdened now by what the Supreme Court has done. Sort all of this out, the Supreme Court said, and give some life to this, certainly a major task as she goes down this road. Presumably in the weeks and months just ahead, even as this campaign goes forward, presumably Tanya Chutkan is going to be establishing a schedule for some of those as she takes up what the Supreme Court has now given to her. Speaking of schedules, we know that coming out of the 11th Circuit and coming out of Georgia, coming out of New York, also significant things having to do with the future of those cases as well. And as Amicus Law Review here continues in our next segments, we're going to discuss what the 11th Circuit did just this past week in determining the decision about whether or not that case, the Mar-a-Lago documents case, should continue in the federal district court. 11th Circuit issuing some major rulings. We'll also talk about New York and what Judge Juan Merchan has before him, as well as Amicus Law Review continues here on the broadcast stations of Civic Media.
This is the Shaw, WAUK.
CBS News Brief. Former President Trump appeared before the Turning Point Action Faith Conference in Florida last night.
During his speech, Trump encouraged Christians to come out and vote. He said that he wants to win in a landslide so big that it's too big to rig, and that if he is brought into power, they won't have to vote again in 4 years because he'll have fixed the country.
CBS's Katrina Kaufman. California's largest active wildfire has exploded in size. The Park Fire has destroyed more than 130 structures so far. The U.S. men's gymnastics team has a chance to medal this Olympics.
The team looked mostly solid, placing second to Great Britain in the first subdivision of qualifying rounds. Paul Judah advanced to the all-around after Brody Malone fell twice on high bar.
To be where I am today is just a result of all the people behind me, myself, my team, everyone.
Frederick Richard will also compete in the all-around.
CBS's Wendy Gillette. CBS News Brief. I'm Lindy Kenyon.
You can always continue the conversation on social media. Share your thoughts when you find and follow Civic Media on Facebook, X, and Instagram.
The Brewers lose at home. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. Another rough night for starting pitcher Freddie Peralta. He gave up 2 home runs in the first inning. By the end of the second, the Brewers were losing 5-0 to the Miami Marlins. The Brewers ended up losing the game at home 6-2. Manager Pat Murphy.
Freddie would like to have those pitches back. You know, it's tough to pitch sometimes when you're behind like that, you know, and he did some good things tonight. He didn't have his best stuff.
The two teams meet again tonight. NFL Jordan Love has a new contract, a 4-year deal worth $255 million, making him the highest paid quarterback in NFL history, $155 million guaranteed, and Love will get a signing bonus of $75 million. So what's next?
Just reps. You know, you just got to get those reps, build that chemistry. Obviously, I've got a good amount of reps through OTAs, but it's different going into training camp. You know, just getting those reps with the guys and building that chemistry with everybody.
That's Packers quarterback Jordan Love. With sports, I'm Mike Clemens.
WAUK weather is sponsored by Planet X in Brookfield. Stocked with the freshest cigars at the best prices, 173rd and West Blue Mound Road.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. For today, sunshine, highs in the upper 70s. Partly cloudy, 68 tonight. Slight chance of a thunderstorm for your Sunday with a high around 82. Scattered storms Sunday night, a low around 70, and a couple of thunderstorms possible on Monday. Otherwise, partly sunny with highs in the mid-80s.
Right now, it's 68.
Introducing Brookfield's newest cigar and vape shop, Planet X. They have endless options with their wide variety of products. Experience luxury in their expansive cigar room, stocked with only the freshest cigars. And the best part? Planet X offers the cheapest prices in Brookfield. Open to serve you Monday through Saturday, 8 a.m. until midnight, and Sundays from 9 a.m. to 10 p.m. Come in today for cigars, vapes, and much more at Planet X.
Hi, I'm Emily from Weikert Realtors Lake Point in Madison. Your home, your property, your decision. At Weikert Realtors Lake Point, we'll guide you every step of the way, whether you're buying or selling a home or exploring commercial property. Your dream is within reach. You'll find our realtors love what they do, and more importantly, we think it's fun helping our clients achieve their goals. Who wouldn't want to do that every day? Give me a call at 608-721-8002. Weikert Realtors Lake Point, 2045 Atwood Avenue. Find more info at weikert-lakepoint.com.
White or wheat, classic or old-fashioned, with or without sesame seed. With so many choices, selecting the right bun for your perfectly grilled burgers, hot dogs, and brats can seem overwhelming. Relax. The bakers at Village Hearth have made your choice easy. With state-of-the-art bakeries and facilities throughout the Midwest, our buns are baked and delivered by folks just like you. So when you see the familiar red Village Hearth logo on the package, you'll be selecting the freshest, most flavorful buns available. Village Hearth Buns. Baked locally, delivered fresh daily.
Covering all the news that affects you with humor and a unique perspective. Matinair on Air with Jane Matinair. Weekdays 10 till noon on The Shaw. 101.1 FM and 540 AM WAUK. And on the Civic Media app.
You are never far away from your favorite radio station. We're always streaming on TuneIn and the Civic Media app. And if you missed your favorite show or game, listen to a podcast of it anytime on the app or our website, civicmedia.us.
Jane Matinair and Greg Bach.
Coming up on the show, we talk to the organization Parents as Teachers, what that would mean for you, mom and dad, and your kids. Plus, all the news from the weekend. We'll recap it. Join us.
Matinair on Air, weekday mornings at 10.
This is Amicus Law Review. We are in the midst of our review, which we sometimes do, of these four major criminal cases pending against Donald Trump, even as he continues as a candidate for the presidency of the United States of America. Talked about Tanya Chutkan, who now has this gargantuan task of figuring out what is the subject of immunity, what isn't the subject of immunity inside this indictment pending in the Federal District Court in the District of Columbia. Lots to do there, lots to unpack there. Presumably some hearings in the months just ahead, even as that campaign goes ahead. We know as well that the other federal case, that it was the one that was pending in the Southern District of Florida, that's the Mar-a-Lago documents case, alleging that Donald Trump and two others, not only obstructive justice, but also engage in violations of federal law when it comes to the retention and use and possession of classified and other documents to which they're not entitled. That case dismissed recently by District Court Judge Eileen Cannon, finding that the prosecutor had no basis upon which to prosecute the case, that the attorney general appointing Jack Smith as special counsel is not constitutional, not supported by any statutory authority, and therefore the entire case goes away. She dismissed the case and closed the docket on it in the district court, much to the surprise of not only people inside the Department of Justice, but also on all sides of the political aisle once again, who viewed this decision as eminently overturnable, meaning that an appellate court, the 11th Circuit here, will almost certainly look at this and say no. Based upon history, based upon precedent, the notion that the special counsel does not have the authority is simply untenable. There's no basis for coming to that conclusion. But that case is now pending before the 11th Circuit. And what it means is that the case, that is the trial, the proceedings that move that case forward in the district court, are suspended. This past Thursday, the Court of Appeals, the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals, the one that oversees the district courts there, finally issued an order and provided information to the parties about the timing of their briefs. This is that period during which Jack Smith and counsel for Donald Trump will be filing written memorandums, written documents, setting forth their positions, establishing basically that there is simply no way that this matter will be tried anytime this year. And arguably not even a decision from the 11th Circuit anytime this year at all. Here's the schedule. Here's the schedule from the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals telling Smith to file his initial brief expressing his views, expressing his positions on these issues by August 27th, about a month from now. Then Donald Trump's lawyers have 30 days after that to respond to that brief. And once that is done, Smith has the chance to file what's called a reply brief 21 days after that. And so if you add all that up, you're coming up against almost Halloween, mid to late October, before the issues will even be briefed before the 11th Circuit. Presumably after that, the Court of Appeals will entertain some oral arguments, and then maybe, but unlikely, sometime late this year, issue its opinion, more likely in 2025. Getting a decision from the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals on whether or not the dismissal of that case can be supported going forward. Again, a prediction here that the 11th Circuit, which has previously overturned Eileen Cannon and other untenable things that she has done, two different occasions, the 11th Circuit said, no, you're wrong. Anticipate that likely the 11th Circuit will say the same thing once again, return the case once again back to the district court for more proceedings sometime, likely in 2025. And then we also have two other cases, or the state cases. The Georgia case, also alleging election interference. That case also up on appeal from Judge Scott McAfee's decision. He dismissed about six counts out of that indictment. And he also found significantly, of course, that Fannie Willis, who's the prosecutor there, does not have to be taken off the case. No conflict of interest of such a nature that she would have to be removed from the prosecution. Finding an appearance of impropriety, but not sufficient to remove her from the case. And that decision, along with the dismissal of some of those counts, both of those things now in front of the Georgia appellate court. While that's going on, that case basically suspended. Unlikely that a trial will happen at any time soon in Georgia there as well. And finally, the one case that will, in fact, be involved in some significant activity fairly soon, that is a New York case. That is a New York case pending in front of Judge Juan Merchan. talked a lot about this on this broadcast. That is the case, once again, that establishes, based upon the jury verdict, finding Donald Trump guilty of 34 counts, felony counts of false statements, fraud in connection with documents prepared, official records of the Trump Organization, involving the hush money payments to Stormy Daniels and the transactions involved in accomplishing that right before and after the 2016 election. That conviction of Donald Trump, a president candidate for the presidency, remains in place, but the district court judge there, Juan Merchan, suspended his plans to engage in sentencing a couple of weeks ago while he considers the impact of the Supreme Court decision, this immunity decision, on the trial of that case. And so he's soliciting and has gotten in some initial briefs in that case as well. The submission by the prosecutor there, Alvin Bragg, makes it clear that the government feels very strongly, as Juan Merchan will probably also conclude as well, that there's nothing to see here, that the issuance of the immunity decision should not, in fact, in any way impact the jury verdict, should not require a new trial, should not suspend the sentencing going ahead. What, in fact, did Alvin Bragg say just this past week? He said that there's no basis to overturn Donald Trump's conviction in this hush money case based upon that presidential immunity decision. Any error, he said, is harmless when viewed against the overwhelming evidence of a president's guilt. Now, Donald Trump's lawyers had argued that this conviction on 34 counts for falsifying these business records should be vacated because the Supreme Court had ruled that evidence of some of a president's official acts should not be used in the course of the trial. They specifically highlighted this notion that some testimony from White House aide Hope Hicks and some tweets from Donald Trump, both of those took place while he was actually the president. Presently scheduled to be sentenced in September, the sentencing, as I said, already delayed to allow arguments about this immunity issue. Prosecutors, once again, in their filing of this past week, dismissing all of that, saying that the crimes that Donald Trump was convicted of, this falsification of business records, happened before the 2016 presidential election, not a part at all of his official conduct, and that for that reason, the Supreme Court's ruling does not at all apply. Also noting that Trump's attorneys didn't raise objections during the trial itself to most of this evidence they now question, arguing that it's now too late to do that. Going on to say this, for all of the pages that defendant Trump devotes to his current motion, the evidence that he claims is affected by the Supreme Court's ruling constitutes only a sliver of the mountains of testimony and documentary proof that the judge considered in finding him guilty of all 34 felony charges beyond a reasonable doubt. The prosecution, Alvin Bragg, goes on to write this. He says, to the extent that the court concludes that any evidence of official presidential acts was improperly admitted at trial, the defendant's request to set that aside, to set the verdict aside, should be rejected on the harmless error grounds because the trial court contains, the record of the trial court contains overwhelming evidence of the defendant's guilt. So what is that notion all about? Well, there's a harmless error concept in appellate review that basically says that even if there was error, not conceded here at all by the prosecution, saying, no, there wasn't error in doing this at all. These were not subject to the Supreme Court's ruling. But assuming that there was error in admitting these bits of evidence in, still it was harmless. Why? Because the jury's verdict based upon the overwhelming evidence could not be overturned, could not legitimately be attacked based upon just those very small slivers of things that was in fact presented in front of the jury. That was the harmless error analysis. The error, if any, in admitting that testimony, that evidence, was harmless in the end, did not affect the jury verdict, and for that reason, Judge Juan Merchan, encouraged by the prosecution not to overturn the verdict, not to postpone further the sentencing. Prediction here, highly likely, Judge Juan Merchan will reject the applications, these motions, these arguments of the defense, and affirm the jury verdict, and he will do that probably in a hearing coming up in September, followed by a written order, and proceed to sentence Donald Trump for the crimes that he was convicted of in that court. sometime in mid-September. September 18th is the day that he has specifically identified for doing that sentencing. That prosecution, again, still going forward. Lots of activity happening there in particular, again, in the wake of the Supreme Court decision finding that a sitting president does, in fact, have immunities. The argument that based upon the timing and the evidence in that New York case, none of that applicable, none of the terms of the Supreme Court decision prevent the court from going ahead with that prosecution. Now, certainly, Donald Trump, once this is all concluded, once the judgment is formally entered, a sentence formally entered, has the right to appeal that, and he will certainly do that after Judge Juan Merchan makes his decision on this immunity issue, the continued vitality of the jury verdict, and also sentence him. And Donald Trump can appeal all of that. He can appeal things related to the trial. He can appeal the decision likely to be entered by Judge Juan Merchan, indicating that he's not reversing the jury verdict. He can also appeal, that is, Donald Trump can appeal the sentence itself, finding that it's somehow illegal or unconstitutional. All of that can be wrapped up in an appeal to the higher court, which he will certainly do. Again, a prediction that Juan Merchan will go ahead. And long before the campaign is completed here, long before the November election, that this particular trial court matter will be concluded, even as it goes up on appeal. Highly likely that if the court does impose a sentence on September 18th, that will be stayed, probably not executed, will probably be stayed as the campaign goes forward, and specifically as the appeal on these underlying issues also proceeds, not going to be executed at any time while the appeal is pending. Juan Merchan will almost certainly stay his order to let that appellate process go forward. All of that pending, again, in the state and the federal courts of our land in the wake of what the Supreme Court did. No small consequence to these opinions, both in the Congress of the United States, in these courts, and also, I would argue, should be inside the minds and the hearts of all Americans as we think about what our country is and what the future of our nation is in the wake of this dramatic change in how our government works, that in the wake of Loper Bright, and this rescission of a major concept inside our Constitution about checks and balances, and significantly, most importantly, that a president should not be immune for crimes committed in the Oval Office. No one is above the law. In that connection, the Supreme Court, of course, continues to fill its docket for cases that's going to hear in the 2024-2025 term. And we turn now to some of those issues related to things happening right now, including just this past week. The Supreme Court has previously indicated it's going to be taking up a Tennessee law that bans gender-affirming care for transgendered youth. That's already on its docket. That's already going to be decided in the coming term. Motions and memorandums, briefs being filed in that case already. And the Supreme Court will be taking up oral argument in that case, deciding that in probably this time next year, late June, early July. Major U.S. medical groups like the American Academy of Pediatrics, the American Medical Association have opposed efforts by states to restrict gender-affirming care. And in the wake even of that, Tennessee enacted a law at the center of this case in 2023, bars gender-affirming care like hormone treatments, gender transition surgeries for transgendered patients under 18. That's what the law says. The law carved out two exceptions to that general rule, allowing the use of hormone treatments for other patients under 18, for those who already began puberty too early, and also allows healthcare providers to continue to administer hormone treatments for patients already receiving it. That's the law that's subject to the challenge. As we return here on Amicus Law Review, more about that Tennessee law and what the Supreme Court's going to be doing in the coming term as it takes up that significant case, that challenge to that law in Tennessee.
The Shaw, WAUK, Waukesha's home for Nightlight with Peach Wabba.
Do you owe back taxes? Call Tax Solutions now and get some help. For a limited time, the IRS offers a tax forgiveness program called the Fresh Start Initiative. Our team can make it easier for you to pay back taxes, avoid tax liens, and get a fresh start.
I call Tax Solutions now, and they got the IRS off my back.
Call Tax Solutions now. 800-281-8193. 800-281-8193. 800-281-8193.
Are you a veteran who needs assistance? Do you know a veteran who needs help? The Wisconsin Department of Veterans Affairs is here for Wisconsin veterans, their families, and their survivors. We can help connect veterans with services such as medical care, financial and legal assistance, housing, mental health services, substance use treatment, and more. For more information, please visit wisvets.com. That's wisvets.com. Sponsored by the Wisconsin Department of Veterans Affairs, with funding provided by the Milwaukee Brewers and the Brewers Community Foundation.
You're listening to The Shaw, WAUK.
This is Amicus Law Review. We are talking about the next cases among the 20 or so cases already identified by the Supreme Court to be decided in its next term, including this major issue, which may animate a lot of what the Supreme Court is going to be focusing upon in the 2024-2025 term, and that is transgender rights. Much on the docket of the Supreme Court coming out of this Tennessee case, this legislation in 2023 that bars gender-affirming care, including hormone treatments, gender transition surgeries for transgender patients under 18, some exceptions to that. But that case coming up to the Supreme Court. Also, another case coming out of Kentucky. The legislature there in that state, a similar ban passed by the Kentucky legislature over a veto by Governor Andy Beshear. Seven transgender teens in that state, their parents went to court to challenge that similar Kentucky law, likewise seeking an order that would prohibit the state from enforcing its ban on puberty blockers and hormone therapy. The district court judge in that case had granted their request, put it on hold while the state appealed, and indeed a panel of the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals reversed the trial judge's rulings and reinstated both the Tennessee and the Kentucky bans last fall. And so that's what brings us to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court has now granted certiorari coming out of the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals that had reinstated the legislative bans on gender-affirming care in both of those states, in Tennessee and Kentucky. That matter up for decision by the Supreme Court. And while that happens, having to do with gender-affirming care, another issue percolating up just this past week, and it has to do with something separate but much related, and it falls under Title IX, which is one of the major education statutes in our nation. The Biden administration establishing a rule under Title IX that expands existing federal protections against sex discrimination and harassment to include sexual orientation and gender identity. It would bar the refusal to use a student's preferred name or pronoun and would order schools to allow students to participate in athletics consistent with their gender identity. All those things are part of the rule under Title IX announced by the Biden administration. Again, doesn't have to do with a care, which is the other case, but this has to do with inside the academic setting. What does discrimination mean? What does the prohibition against sexual orientation discrimination, gender identity discrimination mean? The Biden administration, again, through its education department, was aimed at strengthening the protections for gay and transgender students. And that happens to apply to some 10 different states under rulings from both the Fifth and the Sixth Circuits that happened just on Wednesday, again, coming out of the Sixth Circuit. The two rulings on a single day finding that this particular rule cannot stand, that it is unconstitutional, that is inconsistent with Title IX, that it is an exercise by the Department of Education, that it's beyond the capacity of the administration to engage in, that now suspends that Title IX rule and prompts the administration to seek an emergency appeal on this matter to the Supreme Court. We talked before about Elena Kagan's feeling that these emergency appeals are overused. But both the Fifth and the Sixth Circuits just this past week, a day apart, overturned these rules by the Biden administration under Title IX that, again, would protect transgender students in the academic setting, ordering schools to allow students to participate in athletics consistent with their gender identity and requiring them to follow the students' preferred names or pronoun identities. That rule now suspended by the Fifth and Sixth Circuits, prompting the Solicitor General, her name is Elizabeth Prolegar, in an emergency request just this past week, telling the justices that they need to act promptly to restore the legitimacy, even temporarily, of these rules. She says that they should not have blocked all of the Title IX rules when the states claimed that they'd be injured only by provisions that force schools to allow the transgender students to use bathrooms and locker rooms that are consistent with their gender identity. She went on to say that the rule also requires staff and students, once again, to use a transgender student's preferred pronouns, all of that as a part of her emergency application to the United States Supreme Court. The states once again had found that there was no harm to justify an injunction against the regulation provision that defines sex under Title IX, and that includes discrimination based on sex stereotypes, sex characteristics, pregnancy or related conditions, sexual orientation, or gender identity. She specifically invokes the rule in a case called Bostock, a rule that was articulated in a major opinion authored by the Supreme Court by Neil Gorsuch, writing on behalf of the majority, that specifically says that under the federal law that you cannot discriminate against people under Title VII based upon sexual orientation and gender identity, much related, again, to this issue. Now this one under Title IX, a different part of the federal statute. Government arguing that the decision by the lower courts, the Fifth Circuit, the Sixth Circuit in these cases, finding that this Title IX rule, the decision by the Biden administration to enforce transgender rights on behalf of students, that should not be pursued, that should not be upheld, and seeking an emergency appeal to the Supreme Court. The attorneys general, three of them in these various states, have asked the Supreme Court not to accept that appeal, not to put this on a fast track, not to review these matters in an emergency basis, and in fact, to support effectively the lower court decision to suspend the impact of these rules. The Tennessee Attorney General, his name is Jonathan Scrimeti, asked the justices in filing just as late as Friday to reject the government's emergency request to partially pause this order blocking this Education Department rule and asking again that the court not do anything here that would upset the normal course and permit nonetheless the application of the decision by the Fifth and Sixth Circuit to go ahead in its normal course. And that normal course, of course, would be appeal to the Supreme Court. That appeal, if in fact it does pursue on the normal course, would join this other matter that has to do with the gender-affirming care issue coming also out of the Sixth Circuit. The upshot of all this, a lot of focus these days upon the transgender rights of our population, including young people in academic settings and needing medical care. Significantly, the Nebraska Supreme Court also just this past week upheld a law restricting both medical care for transgender youth and abortion. A lot of things going on in this area having to do with transgender issues. We will continue to follow them in the future here on Amicus Law Review, not only in the state courts, not only in the appellate courts, but certainly as our United States Supreme Court now defining transgender issues among the issues it's going to be describing and deciding on in this coming term. As always, join us again next weekend for more of this review here on the broadcast stations of Civic Media.
You're listening to the Shaw WAUK, Waukesha's home for Up North News Radio.
Pete Schwabba.
On the next Nightlight, I welcome radio legend Steve Cochran. And stand-up comedian Zane Lamprey joins me to discuss upcoming dates on the Wisconsin leg of his national tour.
Nightlight with Pete Schwabba, weeknights 7 till 9.
Jazz up your week with the many opportunities to enjoy music at Cutler Park. Jazz at Cutler is featuring Marsha Daniel and her combo on Wednesday, July 24th, starting at 8 p.m. at the Les Paul Performance Center. Following on Thursday, July 25th at Les Paul Performance Center, Jazz Express is playing at 8 p.m. Stop by to tap your feet to the jazzy tunes from the big band era. It's great music and tons of fun for the summer. Jazz up the week at Cutler Park.
You're listening to The Shaw.
WAUK 540 AM Jackson. W266 DR Waukesha.
And always streaming on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, sponsored by O'Reilly Auto Parts.